Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for the vacationing Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have bad, crazy. Let's just cut to the chase. There's no good martini today, but I do have a good chaser, Ian. My streak of never voting for a convicted felon is intact. Bob McDonnell cleared by the Supreme Court unanimously today, his bribery conviction thrown out, so he will not be headed to federal prison, and I can keep that zero on the board.
Well, I mean, until November, in which case, you know, you could... Or maybe, I guess not convicted. So we'll see. We'll see.
The election year is still young, and it's 2016. So literally anything can and probably will happen. But with all that frivolity at the Supreme Court, we unfortunately start with horrific news from the Supreme Court for our actual first martini. It is a very bad martini by a 5-3 decision authored by Justice Stephen Breyer. The U.S. Supreme Court has struck down a Texas law which does such draconian things as banning abortion at 20 weeks when an unborn baby can survive. It would require abortion clinics to have the same type of surgical and other facilities that a outpatient surgical facility does have. Also, it would require abortionists to have admitting privileges to hospitals. And so Stephen Breyer's dissent reads in part, "We conclude that neither of these provisions offers medical benefits sufficient to justify the burdens upon access that each imposes. Each places a substantial obstacle in the path of women seeking a pre-viability abortion. Each constitutes an undue burden on abortion access, and each violates the federal constitution." Ian, when you look at this, it's been clear for a while. It's especially been clear from those videos last year. But when it comes to the left, the health of women has nothing to do with abortion. They just love abortion.
That's exactly right. So basically what's happened is 40 years ago, the Supreme Court made up whole cloth a right to abortion. And then over the course of 40 years, increasingly so, it seems in recent years, they've basically rewritten laws or interpreted laws selectively so that they can uphold that made up right. And that's what they did here. The 20-week ban will still be in effect because it wasn't challenged by the petitioners. But basically, the undue burden provision was interpreted by the Supreme Court in such a way that they could make the decision that they wanted to, which was to strike down those provisions, which reduced the number of abortion clinics in Texas, I think, to single digits, but a fairly small number. And I actually encourage people to read Justice Thomas's dissent in this decision, because he makes the point extraordinarily articulately that effectively the Supreme Court, as you said, Greg, they just simply want this right to exist. And so they go out of their way to completely disregard the evidence provided by the state that this law is a good one or an entirely legal and constitutional one, and basically go on their own sort of fact-finding mission, and by pulling the facts that they prefer can justify the decision that they wanted at the beginning. And he writes, not only, you know, is this bad for people who are against abortion, but it undermines the legitimacy of the court, and it undermines the notion of law applied equally. So he has an almost mournful decision, but it's spot on.
Even more depressing, this decision would have come down the same way had Justice Scalia not died. Secondly, there were two dissents. You mentioned the one from Justice Thomas, which is the much stronger one. The other one from Sam Alito, which was joined by both Chief Justice Roberts and Clarence Thomas, suggested that this should be remanded back to the courts. So Thomas is really the only one who said that this Texas law was good to go the way it was. And that is truly depressing when you look at the balance of the court and the way the balance of the court's likely to look 4 or even 8 years from now.
Alito is making the point, too, that the original jurisprudence surrounding this issue allowed the states to legislate on these points. And basically, that power has been usurped by the court. So the court has been effectively the lawmaking body surrounding abortion in the United States, just like they became the lawmaking body surrounding same-sex marriage in 14. Was that last year? I can't
remember.
Last year,
yeah.
that's part of the reason that the the court is so important in sort of our public mind. That's a significant problem, that the court now has become sort of a third, I suppose, lawmaking branch.
I don't want to tee you off for another 5 or 10 minute commentary here, but this is a serious question. What, according to this court, did Kermit Gosnell do wrong?
I mean, nothing. There's actually, I'm going to have to steal my colleague David French's thunder, but hopefully he's posted on this. There's an amazing, absolutely amazing line in Justice Breyer's majority opinion. I don't have it in front of me, so I'll have to paraphrase, but it says, what Kermit Gosnell did was terrible, but those seeking to do evil will find ways to do it nonetheless, and we don't believe an added layer of regulation would have prevented those crimes, which is a striking argument from a court that is looking for every excuse to put new regulations on firearms ownership that has been terrible on due process, the connection of due process and terror suspects. I mean, that's just an absolute farce for this court to argue that in the case of abortion. So for them, I suppose Kermit Gosnell did this morally reprehensible thing. And then when a legislature, the duly elected representatives of the people, try to create laws that might prevent future episodes, the court is suddenly enormously laissez-faire about regulations. I mean, it's just, it's a tortuous decision, again, designed to uphold a law that they simply want to, or a right that they are simply invested in for political reasons.
Utterly revolting. All right, on to the next bad martini now. Kind of crazy. Ian, I woke up this morning and turned on the radio news, and what I heard was market experts expect yet another day of major stock drops following the Brexit vote in England last week. Yeah, that would be two consecutive days of market losses if, in fact, that continues, which at this point it does. As we record here, it's the Dow is south of 300 for the day. And it could be bad for a while because, as everyone knows, investors hate uncertainty, and there's going to be uncertainty there. But now you've got all these calls for there's going to be massive recessions in Britain that's going to trigger a worldwide recession just when we're trying to come out of the economic doldrums following the financial crisis of 8 years ago. Then you've got folks like the Daily Mail reporting Angela Merkel says that the EU needs to stop other countries following Britain out the door amid market fears that the bloc is no longer governable after Brexit. The German chancellor told her Conservative Party board in a conference call that it was necessary to prevent other European Union members going down the same path as Britain. Merkel is also said to have revealed that international financial markets are concerned that the EU is no longer governable in the wake of Britain's exit vote. It goes on and on, people calling for the Cameron government to do more. Every day of uncertainty prevents investors from putting their funds into Britain and also other European markets, according to a guy named Günther Oettlinger, a German member of the EU's Executive European Commission. He says Cameron and his party will cause damage if they wait until October to take steps to prevent calamity. So fun to watch everybody thinking that Brexit's going to have this massive effect on the U.S. presidential election. And for those people who are more concerned about the financial side, just assume we're all going to be out there with a tin cup by the end of the week.
There's a scene from one of the Monty Python movies where, following sort of a calamity, they show a man walking through the streets of England calling out, you know, bring out your dead, bring out your dead. That sort of apocalyptic tone has characterized all of the coverage almost universally surrounding Brexit since late Thursday night. I mean, it really is sort of the end of the world as we know it, I suppose, according to stock market analysts and, of course, EU bureaucrats and a whole lot of folks who are on the Remain side of this question. They're absolutely right to be sort of a short-term economic shock, which everyone sort of knew was going to happen. There will be long-term consequences, but my colleague Charles Cook was over in Britain as late as yesterday morning, and he was still able to make it out of the country. The government was still functioning. Airlines were still, flying out and flying in. It's just been really sort of shameful the extent to which people have treated this completely legitimate decision of the British people as effectively voting for their own ruination and the ruination of Europe. Everybody just needs to relax, slow down, understand that these decisions will be made over a period of time by legally functioning authorities. Also, you know, as far as the financials go, is the European Union really going to axe the fifth largest economy in the world? Is Germany going to cut off Britain, where it exports one-fifth of its vehicles? I mean, there's a lot of fear-mongering right now, but I think if you take a longer view, we should expect some things to settle down.
I would think so. Well, I think I read that Britain's been in the EU for about 40 years. I think that's roughly about right. Pretty sure 1066 was before the 1970s. So I think they're probably going to hang on. And I think Europe also, as a continent, existed before the 1970s. So chances are they've figured out ways to work together and still be independent in the past. And I think they can probably figure it out again.
That's right. Also, you know, another part of this is, and just something that I think is really, really shameful in sort of the coverage, is the breakup of the European Union would be the end of this sort of period, long-term period of peace post-World War II, and this idea that the EU is the organization that's enforced that. I mean, that's nonsense. The organization that's enforced that is NATO with the help of the United States Armed Forces. The EU has done squat when it comes to the two wars that have been fought in Europe, in Ukraine currently, and back in the Balkans in the 90s. You know, the only force that's kept the peace is the American armed forces, occasionally with the help of allies. So I think that that's a tenuous argument as well.
Yeah, what else is new? The United States doing the work over there. All right, on to the third and final martini. This could be considered probably more crazy than bad. It all depends. It's definitely a little bit of both. This is from Bloomberg. Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump said on Saturday that he would not characterize his immigration policies as including mass deportations. Trump, in an interview at his golf course in Aberdeenshire, Scotland, said that rather than a blanket ban on Muslims coming to the U.S., a position he took in late 2015, he'd focus on those from countries with links to terrorists. The Republican also said he would start from scratch on the sweeping Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. Trump said his immigration policies would have, quote, heart, suggesting that he may be shifting tone to transition into general election mode after the bruising primary season. Quote, President Obama has mass deported vast numbers of people, the most ever, and it's never reported. I think people are going to find that I not only have the best policies, but I will have the biggest heart of anybody, unquote, Trump said. So somehow we've gone from the southern border is a joke to Barack Obama is this guy who's just rounding up people recklessly and deporting them out, and somehow he's too harsh on immigration enforcement, and Donald Trump's the moderate guy with the heart, and the president who just tried to work around the legislative branch and was stopped by the Supreme Court is the draconian one. This is quite the pivot here.
Yeah, this is one of those shoot someone on Fifth Avenue kind of moments. I mean, should Trump people now, if Barack Obama is the real Genghis Khan of immigration enforcement, are they going to try and repeal the 22nd Amendment and, you know, vote Obama in for a third term? I mean, this is just nuts. Now, let me say, as a matter of policy, focusing on folks coming from terror hotspots is a far smarter policy, and it is closer in alignment with a bill that Ted Cruz has right in the Senate. So, you know, as a matter of policy, this is actually a move, I think, in the right direction. But then Trump dilutes the entire issue by offering this nonsense. I mean, first of all, the notion that Obama is some sort of deportation hound is not just prima facie absurd, but is a left-wing talking point that developed about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, to help him beat back the criticism from DACA and his, you know, subsequent executive amnesties. What's actually happened, the Obama administration has reclassified the sort of catch and release at the border tactics as quote unquote deportations.
Right.
And so when you look at the Obama deportation numbers, they're higher than Bush's simply because they've changed the definitions. It's a complete farce what they've done. And of course, Trump has picked up on it and run with it because he doesn't know anything. But secondly, he compounds it with more left-wing rhetoric. I mean, this is the sort of thing that conservatives blanched at, talking about when compassionate conservative came into the lingo. Is the rest of conservatism not compassionate? I mean, is an actual enforced immigration policy suddenly heartless? I mean, the problem is that in these sorts of moments, you see that Trump speaks like a liberal because he is one. This is the vernacular in which he actually comfortably speaks. So not only has he confused the issue by perpetuating false talking points, et cetera, but then he doubles down by using the left's rhetoric to do it. If you're a Trump voter, these are the sort of things that you would say, hold on, wait a minute, I'm confused here. But then again, cults will do what cults will do. So.
Ian, in this Bloomberg interview, Trump was asked to clarify on what his immigration policy would be. Are you ready for this nuance?
Shoot.
Quote, "We are going to get rid of a lot of bad dudes who are here. That I can tell you."
So we're going to get rid of the bad dudes, but we're going to bring the terrific ones back.
Yes.
I see now. That sounds like, just write that into the law.
Specificity. We've been asking for it. There it is. Ian, have a good day despite all this horrific news. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Goodness. We'll talk tomorrow.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and please tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.